VOA News, I'm Michael Brown. Senate Republican leaders apparently don't have the votes to block witnesses from being called in President Trump's impeachment trial. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has the story.
According to an inside source, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told senators privately there are not enough votes to block new witnesses from being called in President Trump's impeachment trial. The Republicans have a 53-seat majority, so just a few defections would mean witnesses would be called, something Majority Leader McConnell was trying to avoid earlier this month.
Democrats' case cannot simultaneously be so robust that it was enough to impeach in the first place, but also so weak that the Senate needs to go fishing.
But news of a manuscript from former National Security Advisor John Bolton yesterday had some GOP members like Mitt Romney in favor of new testimony.
It's important to be able to hear from John Bolton for us to be able to make an impartial judgment.
Jackie Quinn, Washington.
U.S. health officials are expanding their checks of international travelers for signs of the new virus from China. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
The latest update was led by Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar.
Americans should know that this is a potentially very serious public health threat. But at this point, Americans should not worry for their own safety.
So far, he says, there are 5 confirmed cases of the new virus in the U.S.
Part of the risk we face right now is that we don't yet know everything we need to know about this virus. But I want to emphasize, that does not prevent us from preparing and responding.
The CDC has already been checking arrivals at 5 U.S. airports. Now they say they're beefing up screening at 15 more, what they call quarantine stations, around the country. Shelley Adler, Washington.
And for more news, please join us at our website. That's voanews.com with the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled his peace plan for the Middle East on Tuesday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu standing at his side.
As I have seen throughout my long career as a dealmaker, complex problems require nuanced, fact-based remedies. That is why our proposal provides precise technical solutions to make Israelis, Palestinians, and the region safer and much more prosperous.
Notably absent was the representative of the Palestinians who rejected the plan before even getting a glimpse of it and who were not included in talks about the plan. Palestinians National Authority President Mahmoud Abbas called President Trump's Middle East peace deal, in his words, a conspiracy that will not pass. Trump said acceptance of the plan would lead to $50 billion of outside investment, 1 million jobs created for Palestinians over a decade, and a doubling or tripling of Palestinians' gross domestic product. Boris Johnson's government has decided to give Huawei limited access to build parts of its new high-speed mobile network, and a setback for the U.S., which has been pushing allies to ban the Chinese company. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Britain says it's excluding high-risk companies from supplying the sensitive core parts of the new fifth-generation or 5G networks, but it will allow high-risk suppliers to provide up to 35% of the less risky radio access network. High-risk vendors are those who pose greater security and resilience risks to Britain's telecoms markets, a clear reference to Huawei. Washington is concerned about the company as it believes China could, under a 2017 law, compel Huawei to carry out cyber espionage. Huawei, though, denies that would be possible. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Officials in Afghanistan say Taliban insurgents attacked a police post in the northern part of the country, killing at least 13 policemen, including the post commander, Tuesday. A local official told VOA that insurgents raided the police post with the help of a suspected Taliban infiltrator. A provincial police spokesman confirmed to VOA both sides suffered heavy casualties in ensuing clashes, but he did not provide any number of police losses. And some tense moments for people in the Caribbean Tuesday when a powerful 7.7 magnitude earthquake struck the Caribbean Sea between Jamaica and eastern Cuba, briefly triggering a tsunami warning. There wasn't any reports of serious damage or casualties. Tuesday's earthquake came after a series of strong quakes and aftershocks shook Puerto Rico over the last 3 weeks, leaving thousands homeless there. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 29th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A U.S. official is optimistic about the future of some of Africa's trouble areas.
We look around the continent. Yes, there are some serious problem areas. But in each of the rest of the trouble spots in the continent, there is the possibility and the opportunity for peace, for stability, to help move the entire continent forward.
Thibault Nash is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Violence in Sudan's Darfur state sends thousands fleeing to Chad. Kenya dismisses allegations of coronavirus presence in the country. Some Liberians are skeptical about President George Weah's economic message yesterday. And a Malawi businessman accused of alleged attempt to bribe constitutional court judges will be charged today, Wednesday.
We are very happy because justice has prevailed. We said it from the beginning that it was illegal, it was improper, it was erroneous. So we are glad that we've been vindicated and the court has set it aside and restored the warrant of arrest.
Renek Matemba is the director of the Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau. The Ugandan government is said to borrow billions to fund its elections, and Gambian police released detained journalists. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Thibault Nash, says he is hopeful the problems in certain African countries will be solved. The U.S. diplomat recently concluded a trip to Cameroon, Kenya, Somalia, Sudan, and South Sudan. Ambassador Nash spoke to reporters Monday from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, via a teleconference.
It is absolutely possible for the Central African Republic to continue rebuilding the country, to have positive elections in December, and there's even possibility for moving forward constructively in Somalia. So, you know, we look around the continent. Yes, there are some serious problem areas, such as in the Sahel, but in each of the rest of the trouble spots in the continent, there is the possibility and the opportunity for peace, for stability, to help move the entire continent forward.
Ambassador Nash says the U.S. is in talks with the new Sudanese government to address some of the challenges facing the Sovereign Council in Khartoum after the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir.
We have to remember one thing. The new government has been in power in Sudan for approximately 6 months. What we're talking about is not just the SSD, the state sponsor of terrorism, but it's literally like peeling away an onion because there are a number of restrictions on what we can and cannot do with Sudan. Remember, these were built up literally over decades. So bottom line, we see the new government of Sudan as a very positive partner with whom we can do business in a number of areas. We are optimistic. I wish I could give you a time frame.
On South Sudan, the top U.S. diplomat for Africa says although President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar have some challenges, they have no excuse for not forming a unity government next month.
I made the same pitch to both of the protagonists in the South Sudan scenario because there is no reason why they cannot go ahead, form the unity government, and then agree to deal with those issues. Take the number of states. It's really not going to be a technical decision because you can get a committee of experts to come up with very, very precise lines on, you know, exactly where the state should be. But at the end of the day, it's going to be a political decision. You know, just like congressional districts in the United States, they're political decisions. That's what they're going to have to agree on. It's going to be a lot of give and take, you know, 10, 23, 24, 32, whatever. They have to agree to it. So why not go ahead, form the unity government, and then deal with these very difficult issues because each party have their own constituents to resolve. Otherwise, we'll be having the same conversation in a year or who knows, 5 years.
The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa says the Trump administration expects South Sudanese leaders to end the cycle of violence in the country.
We want the process to succeed. We want the people of South Sudan to win. They have suffered enough. They have been abused enough. The elites need to get to the point of serving their own people instead of their own selfish interests. The international community is sick and tired. and fed up with providing the government services that the government of South Sudan should be providing for its own people.
That was Thibault Nash, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, speaking to reporters via teleconference from Sudan's capital, Khartoum. The United Nations Refugee Agency says more than 11,000 Sudanese refugees have fled to Chad this month to escape intercommunal violence in West Darfur State. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The situation in West Darfur has continued to worsen since a dispute between Arab and African ethnic groups ignited violent clashes in El Geneina in late December. The UN Refugee Agency reports that last week alone, 4,000 people fled to neighboring Chad in search of safety. The agency says most of the refugees are among 60,000 people who have been internally displaced during previous fighting in Darfur. UNHCR officials say they expect as many as 30,000 Sudanese could cross the border into Chad in the coming weeks as tensions increase. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balar says new arrivals give accounts of widespread destruction and of being forced to flee after their villages, houses, and properties were attacked, with many homes burned to the ground. While they are safe, he says conditions in Chad are dire.
Most are staying in open or under makeshift shelters with little protection from the elements. Food and water are urgently needed, while health conditions are a concern to humanitarians.
Balash says his agency and others, as well as the Chadian government, are providing life-saving aid and are assisting refugees needing special care, including unaccompanied children. But the UNHCR spokesman says the government and humanitarian agencies are limited in what they can do and says international support is needed. Balar says the refugees currently are scattered in several villages along a span of nearly 100 kilometers close to the Chad-Sudan border. Meanwhile, in West Darfur, inside Sudan, he says aid agencies are rushing relief items such as blankets, sleeping mats, and jerry cans to help those who have been displaced by the clashes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenya's Ministry of Health has dismissed allegations that the coronavirus has shown up in Kenya. This after a student from China arrived at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport yesterday with coronavirus-like symptoms and was admitted in an isolation ward at the Kenyatta National Hospital. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the World Health Organization has asked Kenyan health officers at the country's border points to be vigilant.
Health scrutiny at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport on passengers coming in from China has been tightened following the suspected case of a student who had traveled on a Kenya Airways flight from Guangzhou, showed some of the coronavirus symptoms. Dismissing the allegations, Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary Cecil Kariuki said that the student has been examined and found to be free of the virus.
On examination, the suspected case was found to be in stable condition with all vital signs within normal ranges. Following admission at the Kenya International Hospital, appropriate specimens have been collected for investigation at the National Influenza Center. I want to remain emphatic that this is a suspect at this point in time, and until investigations have run through and that we are satisfied, then we'll move to the next level in terms of intervention.
Aboard the flight, majority were Kenyan students studying in China, and they had been cleared by the health authority in Guangzhou before leaving for Nairobi. Kariuki has asked members of the public showing some symptoms that are associated with the virus and have recently visited China to seek medical attention.
Anyone who is exhibiting symptoms of respiratory illness, such as fever, coughing, difficulties in breathing, sneezing, with a history of recent travel to China, is advised to go to the nearest health facility for assessment and prompt management.
The World Health Organization, WHO, has declared the virus a high risk to other countries. Kenya's WHO representative, Rudy Edges, said that so far there is no cure to the virus and that all countries should screen the passengers coming in from China.
Unfortunately, there's no specific treatment for this virus as yet. For countries such as Kenya, it is very important to screen incoming people from China. We know that of the 2,761 confirmed cases, that almost all of these cases, they're just a handful that do not have a link directly to Wuhan and to China.
At a construction site in Gatundu area of Kiambu County in Kenya, three Chinese nationals were isolated after displaying the symptoms related to the virus. A resident from the area says the residents and workers at the construction site are concerned that they may contract the deadly virus. The latest statistics from China say at least 106 people are dead and more than 4,600 cases have been confirmed in mainland China as the coronavirus spreads across Asia and the rest of the world. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Today is Wednesday, January 29th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. The Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau is going to court today, Wednesday, to formally charge businessman Thompson Pinganjira for his alleged role in the alleged attempt to bribe judges of the High Court of Malawi. This after High Court Judge Dorothy Nyankaunda Kamanga ordered the reinstatement of the arrest warrant against Mr. Pinganjira. The Constitutional Court is hearing the case about Malawi's May 21, 2019 presidential election brought by two opposition parties, asking the court to nullify the results because of irregularities. If local reports are accurate, a verdict is expected as early as Monday, February 3rd. Anti-Corruption Bureau Director Renick Matemba said his bureau feels vindicated by Judge Kamanga's ruling to reinstate the arrest warrant for Mr. Pinganjira.
We are very happy because justice has prevailed. We said it from the beginning when we were told about the order that was granted at night, that it was illegal, it was improper, it was erroneous. So we are glad that we've been vindicated and the court has set it aside and restored the warrant of arrest.
What's the evidence that your commission have that led to the arrest of Mr. Pinganjira? Do you have enough evidence?
Yes, we believe we have strong evidence. If you recall the press briefing that I had with the members of the media here in Malawi, I kept on emphasizing on that fact to say, even though we have received this complaint from the Chief Justice, as an anti-corruption commission, we need to do our work, and that is to investigate. And investigating, we did. So far, I would say we are comfortable with the evidence that we have. In fact, that is the reason why we made a decision to move in and arrest. So, yes, we believe we have strong evidence against the person that we arrested on the 22nd of January.
If Mr. Pinganjira is alleged to want to bribe somebody on this constitutional court, who is he going to bribe for? Is it for the complainant in the election case or for the government of Malawi?
I appreciate your question, but the position that we have taken is not to reveal in whose favor the bribe was attempted to be given or to be paid, because our investigations are still going on. The letter or the complaint that we received from the Chief Justice mentioned two names as the alleged perpetrators of the bribery. We are still investigating. If we are able to disclose, or if we were to disclose in whose favor that was paid, that has the potential to prejudice our investigations. However, tomorrow, we are now formally charging Dr. Pinganjira. And I think that will be able to, that will give a clue to the people of Malawi and the other people beyond our borders that are following these issues.
Mr. Matemba, this election case has gone through so many twists and turns. Are you not concerned that this allegation of an attempted bribery of the constitutional court judges might put another murky wrench in this whole elections case?
We hope it will not, because even the constitutional court itself, from the word go, they reiterated that their decision will be based on the evidence that was presented before the five panel judges or constitutional court, as well as the law on the issues that were raised before it. So we believe the court will stick to its word. In fact, that is what they're supposed to do.
Renick Matemba is the director of the Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau. You are speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. The Ugandan government is set to borrow over $135 million to fund election activities. Election officials say they need this money in coming days to start preparing for the 2021 presidential election. Mugumi David Rakerinch reports from Kampala.
David Bahati, Uganda's State Minister of Finance, told the parliament last week that the government has to borrow money to fund its activities, including the forthcoming 2021 general elections.
The borrowing we are talking about is the borrowing for budget support, and budget support means the whole budget, including everything in the budget.
In addition to funding the electoral processes, the government intends to acquire more money in excess of $2 billion for other activities. The government has also advised the Electoral Commission to consider reducing their budget. Wilfred Nwagaba is the shadow attorney general. He says such suggestions are ploys by the ruling party to have sham elections.
The Electoral Commission will now have an excuse of being lax, of acting negligently, claiming it has no money. Like in the last elections, how do you explain failure to deliver ballot boxes and ballot papers in Kampala and Wakiso when the headquarters is here? So you will have many more cases of that nature.
Parliamentarian Moses Kasibante agrees. He blames the government of poor planning.
The reasoning that they are bringing today, as if it was only brought as an emergency that we are having polls next year. That is not true. Every other budget for the last 5 years, 4 years, must have catered for the election that are taking place next year. It is not that we don't have money, but a government that does not plan 5 years ahead of itself is really the problem.
Julius Kapwepe Mishambi is the head of Uganda Debt Network, which advocates for public accountability.
To borrow for any operational expenditure is not welcome. You need to borrow, but for investment spending, so that you can engine the economy to be able to have capacity to pay back itself. Borrowing for electoral processes is simply consumption, and that cannot take you far, because you have then to increase taxes on citizens to be able to get the money that otherwise you consumed to be able to pay back to the creditors. And that's not good economics.
Uganda's debt burden is estimated at about $12 billion and has been cautioned by the International Monetary Fund to minimize its borrowing. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Some Liberians are expressing skepticism about President George Weah's third annual speech to the national legislature outlining a difficult economic situation in the country. In his speech on Monday, the president said the domestic microeconomic environment was difficult in 2019, characterized by low economic growth of less than 1%, annual inflation, and depreciation of the Liberian dollar by more than 20%. But on Tuesday, the opposition collaborating political parties issued a statement saying the president's message was unrealistic to the current Liberian situation. Reporter Moses Gaziewu spoke to Alexander Cummings, leader of the opposition Alternative National Congress Party of Liberia.
He did not address the issue around corruption, around governance, around reconciliation, not even one word about health in his speech. But even more importantly, he did not address how the economy will be revived. The president's budget was more about promises and not about delivery. We also wanted to point out that it blames trade and geopolitical issues for the lack of growth in our economy. The facts do not bear that out.
President Weah says in the next 2 years, Liberia is expected to grow at 1.4%.
1.4% growth in the context of the size of our economy, look at what our neighbors are doing, is not acceptable. We as a country, as a people, need to have high expectations of ourselves, of our government, and of our country. And I just mentioned, Moses, right around us, right in the Manu River Union, they are growing much faster rates than ours. Why are we only growing 1.4%?
Mr. President has announced that he's working with international institutions, multilateral partners that, like the IMF and the World Bank, to try to stabilize the economy. And in fact, he's withdrawn the Central Bank of Liberia from the economic management team to allow the Central Bank operate as an independent institution.
We did applaud the president for recommending legislation to make the Central Bank more independent. And so, check, we applaud that. That's a good thing to do.
Thinking of the economic management team,
You cannot divorce it entirely. So indirectly, there will have to be some coordination, some discussions, some conversations between the executive branch and the central bank, between monetary and fiscal policy. But I think formally separating it, the two pieces, to give the central bank its independence is not a bad thing to the people.
Alexander Kamis is the leader of the opposition Alternative National Congress Party of Liberia. He was speaking with reporter Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia. Gambian police on Tuesday released five journalists who were arrested over the weekend following a protest in which the demonstrators called for President Adama Barrow's resignation. In all, 137 demonstrators were arrested. Two private FM radio stations also had their operational licenses suspended. As Pandere Mbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, the released journalists have been briefing the media about their condition in detention.
The five journalists were picked up in the wake of Sunday's bloody protest march. The incident had left some paramilitary officers and protesters injured. There was also destruction to property. A group calling itself 3 Years Jodna was behind the protest march. The group has since been banned by the government after being branded as subversive, illegal, and violent movement. They were out in the streets to call for President Barrow's resignation. Pamodu Bojang is the owner of the Brikama-based Digital FM. He was among the detained journalists.
Well, when they first arrested me, I was like when Nelson Mandela was taken to Robben Island, almost 4 to 5 vehicles armed to detain. I was first taken to Busubi police station where they dropped me without telling me anything. They put me in a cell, bare floor, no mat, no curtain.
Bojang's radio station was shut down together with the King FM radio. Both stations have been accused of inciting violence, a charge Bojang denies.
First of all, my arrest was unlawful. And for the first 24 hours, the police haven't provided me with any food at all. So all the cells I've been to, the conditions are terrible. And even criminals, they have rights. So you cannot just arrest somebody without telling him what he or she has done and put him in a cell.
Bojang's radio station has been critical of President Adama Barrow's government. The station covers politics, among other stories of public interest. He alleged that his reporters were manhandled by the police while covering the protest. While under police custody, Bojang said he refused to cooperate with the police.
They asked me to write a statement. I told them I'm not going to write anything. I'm not going to say anything because my constitutional right guaranteed me to remain silent until I spoke to my legal representative. For barely 24 hours or 36 hours, I haven't spoken to anybody, not my family members, not my council. So I was just put in cell.
Bojang remains defiant. He vows that no one can intimidate him.
I am more brave than ever, and I will continue to be law-abiding, and I will continue to do my journalistic work. I will continue to say as it is. If anybody don't want that, you better leave the public office, because the public office is there to be scrutinized.
That was Pandere Mbai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina. And that is it for this Wednesday, January 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good Wednesday.
Hi, this is Larry London, inviting you to join me on February 14th for Border Crossings Presents Urban Chart Legends. Some of the biggest names in urban music, jazz, R&B, hip-hop. It's all on one program on one day, February 14th. Michael Jackson, Kendrick Lamar, James Brown, and many more. Tune us in starting at 1500 Universal right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, sub-Saharan African nations continue to struggle with their anti-corruption efforts. Corruption on the continent, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.